Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Or at least, that's what I do in a normal episode of this podcast, but this is a special episode. In these special episodes, I take a monster chosen by one of my Patreon supporters and give it the in-depth treatment. If you'd like to request a special episode about a monster of your choice, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And, like subscribers at lower levels, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I do for the Deities and Demigods book what I'm doing for the Monster Manual, but more sort of in-depth. Today's episode is requested by Patreon backer Bob Faulkner. Thanks, Bob. Bob asked me to talk about the Devil Dog, but I know from conversation with him that he was really referring to, like, hounds of ill omen in general. And one of the interesting things about this type of creature in Dungeons & Dragons is that there's quite a lot of them. There's a wide range of different monstrous or demonic dogs. And this represents how common this image is in folklore and mythology, and arguably how useful they are in games, although, I mean, I think we'll get into that in a little bit more detail later. Now, the Devil Dog is not a creature from the 1977 Monster Manual. In fact, it appears in the Fiend Folio, the monster supplement released under the auspices of TSR's UK division, which mostly consisted of creatures that appeared in the Fiend Folio column in the magazine White Dwarf. Now, I don't know if the Devil Dog is one of those. And I'm going to discuss briefly the Devil Dog entry in the Fiend Folio, because actually I don't know that it has an enormous amount to do with the Hound of Ill Omen, although I think there are a couple of connections. Okay, so the Devil Dog appears in the lengthy D section of the Fiend Folio. It's got some good art by Alan Hunter. Hunter, an artist whose contributions to the Fiend Folio tend to be overlooked, because when you think of the Fiend Folio art, you think of Russ Nicholson. But actually, Hunter's art is quite atmospheric, and I like this image here of an adventurer fending off a pack of vicious dogs. So Devil Dogs are basically big, mean dogs. They're white in color, and they use this fact to creep up on you in the snow, right? They're invisible beyond a distance of 30 feet if they're in a snowy environment, because their white pelts blend in with the snow. And they basically contain a mini called shot system. That is to say that they can make a special attack in which they bite you in the throat that does extra damage, but it's harder for them to hit. And if they do tear your throat out, well, I mean, that's not good. Even if you don't go down to zero hit points, you go comatose and you start to bleed out. You know, someone has to come along and cast Cure Light Wounds on you, or else you'll just die. They're very, very fast, and they cause fear with their howling, or their baying is the word that they choose here, which I think is exactly right. And that, I think, is going to be one of the key points that we're going to come to later. Again, in kind of an interesting little rules twist, the Devil Dog can't maintain its maximum speed for very long, although, I mean, even its regular speed is actually pretty fast, or its regular speed is 12, and it can rest and restore its ability to run at maximum speed while running at this minimum speed. So they're very, very fast. They have a bite attack that they use to bring people down, and they can cause fear. Now, there's no mention in the Devil Dog entry of Devil Dogs working for anyone, right? They just seem to hunt in packs, and that's certainly what the illustration shows, is a pack of these hounds swarming on a guy. But I want to posit that the Devil Dog is connected to one of the two main, or maybe three main, types of folkloric dogs. Let's talk about what those types are before we go any further. Now, the term that Bob used, Hound of Ill Omen, is typically what we would think of as a black dog. Now, black dogs are a very characteristic element of British folklore. Here in Cambridgeshire, I guess we're just on the fringe of sort of black shuck country. In East Anglia, black shuck is the characteristic black dog. But what exactly black shuck does is not always super clear. Sometimes it's very hostile and attacks people. Sometimes it's simply a harbinger of doom. So if black shuck appears, someone is going to die or some kind of disaster is going to take place. And sometimes black dogs are positive, like people are lost or they're in danger, and the black dog appears and lights their way out. Black shuck is the East Anglian version, but there are lots of other ones with lots of different names. Many of which have turned up in Dungeons & Dragons or in fantasy role-playing games under different names. So, for example, one northern version of the Black Dog is called the Bar Guest. The Black Dog plays on an aspect of dogs that makes them different from other kinds of animal, which is that dogs to humans are sort of ambiguous. On the one hand, we know that they are dangerous, especially a big dog can really do you a mischief. People have been killed by dog attacks. But on the other hand, they can be helpful and friendly. So if you're out in the middle of the night and on the road you encounter this strange dog, you don't quite know what you're dealing with. It could be a dangerous animal, or it could be a good boy. And it's that ambiguity that makes dogs so interesting. They're wild, but they're also civilized. Unlike, say, the wolf, which we've taken to be our type animal for wildness, you know, what you think about wolves and what you think about the wilderness are very similar to each other. And you can see that as romantic notions of the wilderness began to replace fearful ones, and wolves became sort of rehabilitated from the idea that they were cruel, like the big bad wolf, to the idea that they were cool, like the Three Wolf Moon t-shirt. So unlike wolves, dogs are ambiguous, and they're ambiguous because they're civilized. It's not as simple as saying that civilization is good and wilderness is bad. We know that civilization can be dangerous. And one example of civilized-ish dogs who are dangerous is the wild hunt. Now, that is to say that these are basically hunting hounds, and many of the behaviors that the devil dogs exhibit seem like they would be good for hunting hounds. They're fast runners, they terrify their prey, and they know to go for the throat and bring the animal down. So hunting dogs are part of a myth or legend that relies for its power on inverting the norm, right? So we're frightened of being hunted by the wild hunt because, of course, it is normally we who do the hunting. It's people who have the pack of hounds and who chase a fleeing animal with them. So there's a cruel irony in being chased by the pack. Alternatively, it represents something like our relationship with our quote-unquote superiors. So obviously hunting with a pack of hounds is an aristocratic behavior. It's not something most of us have ever done, legal or otherwise. You know, even when hunting with hounds was legal, most people never did it. So the idea of the person being chased by the wild hunt always has that little tinge of the idea that, oh, well, you know, we all think of jaded aristocrats who hunt people for sport. And there's definitely that sense that, well, we are kind of just animals to them, aren't we? They would do this if they thought they could get away with it. And you can see this in the way that the wild hunt is often associated with fairies. You know, I've said before that fairies and elves and whatever often represent how people think about the aristocracy, and they kind of have that sort of like childish, not childish sense that we often attribute to aristocrats, that they're simple. They don't really 100% understand how the world works, but at the same time, they're powerful and capricious and cruel, right? There's something both sheltered and jaded about elves. Now, there is another animal that fills this role in Dungeons and Dragons, and it appears in the Monster Manual 2, and it's called the Kooshie, C-O-O-S-H-E-E, but what it really is, of course, is the Kooshie, the fairy hound. But they're just referred to as elf dogs, and they're really just dogs. They're just like, just as the elves are kind of literalized into just this non-human civilization with customs and languages and laws, and they sort of get demagicified to a certain extent in Dungeons and Dragons. Similarly, their fairy hounds just become a particular breed of dogs that lives in woodland elven settlements and is used for hunting. So they're just particularly big, fast, powerful dogs used by wood elf hunters to bring down the kind of big game that you might get in a magical forest. So they're neat, but they're not terribly interesting. They're just kind of super dogs. The third folkloric and legendary dog that's common is the guardian dog. So, I mean, we talked about dogs as, you know, helpful animals. We talked about dogs as hunting animals. And, of course, the third role in which we might encounter dogs mythologically is as guard dogs. And the most obvious example of these is Cerberus, the dog who guards the entrance to the underworld in Greek mythology. You could also say maybe Garm, who is a hound in Norse mythology, but I don't think that we know all that much about Garm. We know that he lives in a cave, and we know that he is chained up, and we know that he is someone that you would meet on your journey to the underworld. So it just sound a bit like he's kind of a Norse Cerberus. And the only real question is, you know, have our medieval and later sources familiar with the myth of Cerberus kind of tried to fit Garm into that template? But again, it makes sense. We're familiar with the idea of hounds guarding the entrances to things, or dogs guarding the entrances to things. And so this just fits in neatly with our conception of dogs as ambiguous, right? They inhabit border areas, so they're guardians of the underworld or the otherworld. And so far, what we've seen are that mythological dogs are kind of otherworldly. So when we have another world in our games, whether that's an underworld, like hell or, you know, the afterlife, or another world like the or an otherworld like the realm of fairy, we are interested mainly in stories that involve people from our world coming and going from these other worlds. And usually the assumption is that you don't, that if you are taken away to fairy, you don't come back. But the stories that we're interested in concern people who do. Same with the underworld. Obviously, for most of the time, you go to the underworld, well, it's a one-way ticket. But people who come back from the underworld are more interesting. And so it's journeys to the underworld in which we encounter these guardian dogs. So when we have another world, we're like, oh, it's interesting that, you know, people come and go from it. What would it be like if you had to journey there? What guardians might you encounter along the way? And if you wanted to get out of it or into it without authorization, who might be interested in stopping you? Similarly, one of the questions might be, how do you get there in the first place? And the idea would be that you would be hunted down by the people who live there, right? You're running along and now, you know, this hunter with his pack of hounds is coming to get you. And when he gets you, he's going to drag you away to the underworld or to the realm of fairy, there to live out the rest of your days, or I guess be dead in the case of the underworld. So maybe this is like an escaped fugitive type of situation. And that fits as well with sort of later media, right? I mean, think about O Brother, Where Art Thou, where prisoners escaped from a chain gang are, again, people who are supposed to be within the dominion of the underworld. Or, you know, think about the images of, like, in 19th century America, like slaves escaping along the Underground Railroad being pursued by packs of hounds. So this idea, this fear of being pursued by hounds is both a fear of being chased and being caught, and also a fear grounded in reality of being treated like an animal. And it's interesting that our, you know, one of the symbols that we use to represent being treated like an animal is itself an animal. Now, one thing that I said earlier was that a lot of these hound legends that I'm citing come from aristocratic cultures familiar with hunting, who thought of hunting as, you know, a definitive kind of aristocratic pastime. And this is definitely true for the hounds of the underworld, the hounds of Anuvin in Welsh mythology. Welsh mythology. Now, obviously, I'm quoting here from Charlotte Guest's version of the Mabinogion, and I know that there are enormous textual problems with this. You know, this is a translation of a translation of a selection of a bunch of different texts, and there is really no such thing as the Mabinogion per se. I'm not an expert in Welsh literature at all, but that is my understanding of the situation. Here's the thing, though. As I keep trying to tell myself in my other podcast, Patron Deities, it's not actually that important to be authentic to the mythology when we're talking about Dungeons & Dragons, right? I mean, for one thing, we're going to take it and change it no matter what. So somebody's already taken and changed it. That is okay. And secondly, if we're looking at the history of the game and its influences, then ultimately that's already what we're dealing with. You know, people who created these creatures were working off secondhand sources and bad translations and so on as well. The influence of these things on popular fiction is almost always not through the kind of sources that academics use, which tend to be, you know, comfortable with ambiguity. But if we've got to have a decision about what this thing is like, we are actually more likely to use, you know, a source that has serious problems, because one of those serious problems will be that it takes unclear material and tries to make it certain. Anyway, that's a long way of saying, here's a bit from the Mabinogion, in which we encounter the Hounds of Anuvin. So, Powell is out hunting, and he sees a bunch of hounds bring down a stag, and he chases them away and sets his own hounds on it. And lo, as it reached the middle of the glade, the dogs that followed the stag overtook it and brought it down. Then looked he at the color of the dogs, staying not to look at the stag. And of all the hounds that he had seen in the world, he had never seen any that were like unto these. For their hair was of a brilliant shining white, and their ears were red. And as the whiteness of their bodies shone, so did the redness of their ears glisten. And he came towards the dogs and drove away those that had brought down the stag, and set his own dogs upon it. And then as he's doing this, the master of the hunt comes along and rebukes him for his discourtesy in chasing away another hunter's dogs. You know, that's a faux pas. That's a breach of aristocratic etiquette, right? You know, if another hunter's brought down the stag first, then it's not polite for you to chase off his dogs. But there, I think, we see something like the devil dog, even though the behavior of the hounds of Anuvin doesn't really match the devil dogs otherwise, but just that thing about them being bright white, although their devil dogs don't have red ears. I mean, there's something uncanny about them, right? They were not like any other hounds he'd seen in this world. And I think that that's important for the devil dog, right? That it be an unnatural color. The whiteness of the Fiend Folio devil dog is as unnatural almost as the complete blackness of Black Shuck, or the glowing aura of the Hound of the Baskervilles, which is, of course, rooted in this series of legends of black dogs and hellhounds. Now, when I looked at the illustration in the Fiend Folio, the first thing that I thought was, these dogs certainly look like wolves. And I think it's very important that they are dogs and not wolves. I've mentioned one reason, which is that dogs partake of a kind of ambiguity about their status as civilized, whereas wolves are very firmly uncivilized. And so dogs, in many ways, give a greater range of possibilities in terms of what you can do with them. And I don't just mean tactically, like there could be a pack of devil dogs and they have a huntsman. There could be a pack of devil dogs, but they are told to bring you down but not necessarily kill you, etc., etc., right? If the goal is to hunt you down and take you off to the land of faerie. But more than that, there's something ambiguous in our relationship about dogs. Being mauled to death by wolves seems fitting. Being mauled to death by dogs seems perverse. It seems transgressive in some way, because we expect, at some level, that dogs are our friends. Even though there's a part of us, when a dog growls at us, there's a tiny little part of us that goes, you know, this is actually a fierce animal. And maybe not when it's like a pug, but if it's a big dog, you can feel a little bit nervous, even though you know that it is a friendly dog and a good boy. The other thing is that, I've talked about this before, there's an idea that early Dungeons & Dragons, and British Dungeons & Dragons in particular, partake of what's known as the pathetic aesthetic. And that's the idea that the exaggerated heroism that we think of as characteristic of D&D, that your heroes are bold warriors undertaking noble quests in the mode of the Lord of the Rings, is not so present in the earlier versions of the game. It's really a creation of the kind of Dragonlance era. The idea is not that your characters are destined heroic warriors, but instead that they're a bunch of scoundrels and rascals on the make, that the model is much less the Lord of the Rings and more the Dying Earth, or even, you know, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, who do wind up in heroic confrontations with monstrous evil, but usually in a path that starts out with them being motivated by some form of petty self-interest or stupidity. Or like Conan, who is constantly just kind of blundering into dire situations, right? Most of the time, Conan doesn't set out to get himself into trouble. He just leads the kind of life where it happens a lot. And sometimes the trouble is inconsequential, and sometimes the fate of nations hangs on it. But he doesn't usually make those decisions. Stuff just kind of happens to Conan, because he's the kind of person that kind of stuff happens to. My point is that being killed by dogs is in keeping with the pathetic aesthetic. Right? If you are slain by a pack of wolves, that is definitely the kind of thing that it could be a horror story, or it could be a tale of heroic defeat. But if you were slain by a pack of dogs, it's a horror story, or it's, you know, a farce of some kind. Like in a crime story, someone could get killed by a pack of dogs, but couldn't get killed by a pack of wolves. That wouldn't make any sense. So having someone killed by a pack of dogs sends a thematic message that is not the same as having them killed by a pack of wolves. Consider, for instance, the Winter Wolf, a bright white with kind of blue accents, you know, cold climate monster, not at all dissimilar from the Devil Dog, but the Winter Wolf stands and fights, blasting you with its breath weapon, whereas the Devil Dog uses its superior speed to chase you down. Regarding the baying of the Devil Dog, I think that's definitely a thing in several of these stories, this idea that the baying of the hound strikes fear into all that hear it. I mean, it's definitely a feature of the Hound of the Baskervilles. It's present in a lot of Black Shuck stories, right? The idea that when the black dog bays, that means that someone's going to die, or indeed someone dies upon hearing it. So they partake a little bit of the nature of the banshee, or as it's known in D&D, the groaning spirit. That one didn't stick around. And it also reminds me of that famous invocation. Now, like most people, I first came across this quote in the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Horror at Red Hook, where it's an inscription found in an old church. And it goes, "O friend and companion of night, thou who rejoicest in the baying of dogs and spilt blood, who wanderest in the midst of shades among the tombs, who longest for blood and bringest terror to mortals, Gorgo, Mormo, thousand-faced moon, look favorably on our sacrifices." And this is an invocation to Hecate, the Greek goddess associated with witchcraft, night, and the underworld. Now, interestingly, this is not a quote from a source that is like a worshiper of Hecate. This is comes from the Encyclopedia Britannica section on magic. Lovecraft swiped some of his stuff from there, and I'm grateful to Jason Colavito for writing about the original source here, which is from The Refutation of All Heresies by Hippolytus. So this is a Christian writer characterizing the priests of Hecate as a bunch of fakers. So he makes up this chant for them, and whether it is authentic or not, I don't know that we know. But it's pretty good, and I think it's significant, again, that it's the howl of dogs, right? Dogs always have this sort of weird association with the night, with death, and even with magic, that makes them ideal kind of murky, ambiguous borderland figures. Don't know that that necessarily means the Devil Dog in the Fiendfolio. And, you know, one of the things about the various dog monsters in the Monster Manual is that what they have done, as D&D often does with folkloric creatures, is take this kind of broad and often ill-defined category and try to break it down into specific entries for specific monsters. So I don't think that there's really a difference between the Devil Dog and the Hellhound and the Kushi and the Barghest, right? They're all just magic dogs, dogs of ill omen, dangerous, ominous creatures. But for Dungeons and Dragons, that's not really the this is not really how the game works. You know, we need to have specific entries with specific statistics. And I think when we look at folkloric creatures and we find ourselves asking, like, well, what specific type of creature is this? We are committing a modern error, and indeed one that is largely the result of things like Dungeons and Dragons, where specific type of creature is a thing that we're very concerned about, much more concerned about than ancient and medieval sources would have been, or even early modern sources, right? I'm not claiming that these black dogs and things are medieval or ancient in their origins. Yeah, okay, there is a black dog legend from the 1570s that occurred in the town of Bungay in southeast Suffolk, and it's about how the Hellhound attacked a church, and a church was struck by lightning, and the Hellhound was accompanied by the storm. I mean, not very similar to the ominous Black Shuck, other than it's a big dog and it's black. But there you go. That's more of what I mean. People today will tell you that that was Black Shuck, and it was all to do, you know, it's connected to Black Shuck. So I think that just, again, goes to reinforce the idea that these categories are not necessarily distinct. Indeed, one thing you could do would be to just take a bunch of different monster types that are all kind of dog-like, you know, hellhounds and devil dogs and barghests and whatever, and just refer to them all as the same thing in your campaign setting. You know, for the convenience of the DM, it makes sense to have the different categories. You know, it's just easy to know who can do what and who can move how fast and so on. But there's no reason to extend that same courtesy to the players. And they might very well think, you know, in the same way that you wouldn't assume what a character could do just because, say, they're a human, right? In a Dungeons & Dragons setting, being a human doesn't mean you can't fly or spit fire or whatever. But you're still a human. You're still a person. In the same way that, like, well, some of these dogs have terrifying howls, and some of them breathe flame, and some of them do other things. You know, they're not all the same. Anyway, That's the Devil Dog. And I apologize for diverting from the Devil Dog entry in the Fiend Folio to talk about hellish or fairy dogs more generally in games, but I really do think that the context of the Devil Dog is as interesting, if not more, than the monster itself. So that has been the episode on Devil Dogs. I'm interested to hear about your local... I mean, one of the things that you'll get about the Devil Dog or the Yeti or whatever that you won't get from a lot of monsters is... One thing you'll get about the Devil Dog that you won't get about a lot of monsters is that there is actually a lot of real local folklore about Devil Dogs in a way that there isn't about, like, Hydras. So if you have a local Devil Dog, Hellhound, Black Dog, whatever... I'd be super excited to hear about it. Tweet me at Gonzo History or comment on the Patreon page if you're a Patreon supporter, or even send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com, and we'll discuss them on the show. It's rare that we get to talk about a monster that has a local folklore element, so I'm really interested to hear about it. Okay, that's it for this special episode of Monster Man. If you'd like your own special episode, as I said before, you can go to patreon.com/monsterman and subscribe. Otherwise, new episodes come out every Tuesday and Friday. We're going through the Monster Manual one chunk at a time. Nearly done, only zombies left to go, but after that we'll be tackling the Fiend Folio, and after that, Monster Manual 2, so stay with us. I hope to see you next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at Gonzo History or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.